ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Did you know that high-heeled shoes were originally invented for men? Or that Neil Armstrong's spacesuit was actually made by bra makers? I'm Mark Fennell, and these are just some of the weird and wonderful stories you don't often find in history textbooks, but you can find them by listening to my podcast. No one saw it coming. There are new episodes every week, and you can hear them now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this Global Roaming, we're taking you to meet someone who's spent their entire working life at the highest level of the international system, advocating for refugees.
From Syria to Sudan, from the Mediterranean to Myanmar, we want to find out where the system is making it right.
And what are the costs of getting it wrong?
I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Latika Burke. Welcome to our exit interview with the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees. So Kylie, you know our next guest. How do you know him? And more importantly, when and where did you first meet?
So Filippo Grandi, who has been most recently the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, at one stage ran the operation for the UN in Afghanistan. And actually, when I was a correspondent there based in Kabul for the BBC, he was running the humanitarian affairs activities for the UN there. You know, as happens in these places where everyone is kind of thrown together and there is insecurity and there is curfews, you know, you end up bumping into people. And I always found him to be, I've got to say, very warm and a very kind of passionate advocate for the job that he did. It was a tricky time to be in Afghanistan. There was lots of military there because, of course, there was an international security force. And he was trying really hard, I think, to focus on the future for Afghans in terms of what humanitarian support could be given to them. He's had a long career. He's widely respected. Yeah, I'm excited to be talking to him again.
You know, it's fascinating listening to you talk about this because the Afghanistan mission in many ways feels like a lifetime ago, doesn't it, Kylie? If you think about all the other conflicts and the way that the migration story has changed from 20 years ago now, you know, someone like Filippo Grandi is dealing with how many more conflicts since then?
Absolutely. And those also, there are these chronic conflicts or chronic crises that aren't solved. I would say that the ebb and flow of refugees from Afghanistan continues to this day. I came away from my time as a foreign correspondent feeling like the world is very joined up. You know, I go to Sydney and I see the Kurdish community there. I see the Vietnamese community there. All of these people's lives have been affected by global events that we think of as being so far away. But actually, they're just not. That's not the way the world works anymore. So yes, as we've been saying, Filippo Grandi, let's introduce him formally, Latika. He's held down for the last 10 years one of the biggest jobs in the international system as the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Before that, he's spent decades in the field from Afghanistan to the Palestinian territories, Africa's Great Lakes, Iraq and Sudan. Now he's newly retired in Geneva and he spoke to us via his iPad earlier. Filippo Grandi, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you very much.
Back in the 1990s, you were there in Sudan as a young field officer when the UN opened its field office in Khartoum. And in your final journey as UN High Commissioner for Refugees last month, you were there again. How would you describe the scale of the crisis there now?
Pretty catastrophic. There's a war that has been going on since early 2023. So in the next couple of months, we'll get to the third anniversary. It's a civil war between basically the army of Sudan and a splinter group of the army in Sudan. And they've been vying for power, for control of territory, for control of resources, supported in different ways by other states for all this time. And this is a very characteristic civil war of our times, where the main victims are the civilians. You may say civilians are always the victims of war, but what characterizes war in the last 10, 15 years is a deliberate targeting of civilians, a deliberate campaign of terrorizing people, of obliging them, compelling them to be displaced. And of course, this goes with killings, mutilations, forced recruitment of children, taking everything away from people, spoiling people from their basics. It's really quite catastrophic. And the problem with the war in Sudan is that it has not captured international attention, and it has not, more importantly, or maybe as a consequence, it has not become an important political issue for the international community to address and solve. So peace negotiations have been going on for years, but they're really, there's no energy in it, there's no interest, and they're not progressing.
Why do you think that is?
I think that there's many reasons for that. One is, of course, that there's been throughout this time, since 2023, and this is a terrible word to use, but it's a reality, competition by other crises that are more high profile, of greater strategic interest, Ukraine, Gaza, Israel, Palestine, Israel. And those have captured, have siphoned off the energy, the political energy of the international community. I always say, you know, these two rivals, the army and the RSF, this is the militia that is fighting against the army, you know, they're not Russia and Ukraine. They're not even Israel and Palestine with all the politics behind. It should not be impossible to bring them to the negotiating table. I think that here, and again, in response to your question, what plays in is interest, regional interest. Everybody knows that the UAE is supporting the RSF. Everybody knows that Egypt is supporting the army. Fair enough. You know, these things are political realities, but there's been pronouncements. Last September, Egypt, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the US said, let's get together, let's make an effort. They put some roadmap in front of the parties. Nothing has happened. So it's very frustrating. And sorry to go back to my previous hat, you know, this generates enormous displacement. When I was in Sudan in December, I went to see some of the people displaced from El Fasher, one of the towns that have been most embattled and recently taken over by the RSF. The stories I heard are unbearable. The world should be indignant, like it was 20 plus years ago when big stars and everybody mobilized for Darfur. The crisis is in Darfur again, and yet we don't see this mobilization.
I mean, you mentioned any number of international players are involved in staking the conflict there. The UAE, Egypt, the Saudis and Russians are accused of supplying weapons. But I wonder where the international coalition is that's working for peace. I mean, it's being handled by people who don't seem to have any purchase, any power.
Yeah, it's, I think in early September, there was a statement by, it is called the Quad. This is four countries mostly engaged, Egypt, UAE, Saudis and US. The statement was very good. The statement laid out a roadmap, ceasefire, negotiations, and so forth. These are great initiatives, but they need to be followed up by concrete steps. I think it was very important that the US was part of that. And, you know, President Trump has been very vocal about being a peacemaker. And I think it's great that he certainly encouraged his administration to be part of this effort. But statements are not enough. Peace is not just statements. Peace is very excruciating negotiations, compromises, talks. You give, I give in exchange. That's what peace is about, and it may take a long time. I am not sure I see this happening, although I may not be involved in the details of it, but that's what needs to happen now.
Filippo, for 10 years, you were UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which means that you assumed office just as Donald Trump did in the United States. I mean, back in 2016, that came as a shock. But watching the pictures from Minneapolis this week, I've got to ask, how has he, do you think, as president, through his leadership, changed the politics around immigration and providing refuge?
I want to give you a little bit of a broader answer. I think that there is a deliberate design. I mean, there's no secret here that the world order based on a set of conventions, treaties, rights, bodies like the UN is very much at risk now. I also think that we need to reflect on Mark Carney's world, that the old world order also was not perfect. Far from that. I've been saying this for quite some time myself, modestly, that, you know, the 1945 order with five countries having veto power in the Security Council, but even more than that, with a lot of political practice being really very self-serving for the most powerful countries, had to be reformed. I often say that one inflection point, in my opinion, happened a few years back during COVID. COVID was a global catastrophe, right? It hit all of us in the same way. But when the vaccines were produced, it took a long time for vaccines to be shared. And rich countries that had produced vaccines served them first, and then only after a while, and very partially, countries that could not afford to produce it and had to take it from them. So that was the indication that that world order that still prevailed, nobody was disputing it back then, was imperfect, if it allowed such injustice to happen. So I think that those of us who believe that the 1945 order is still valid to preserve peace and security, then we need to all go back to the drawing board and see where its imbalances, its injustices, its inequalities are, and try to correct them.
I noted with interest that when you pointed out the flaws of the way the international order has been operating, you talked about the dominance of those five countries having the veto power on the UNSC, for example. What you didn't talk about was the application of your patch, which is refugees and migration, which is arguably really been the lightning rod for populists right across the world. Now, we're very familiar with this debate in Australia, where the application of asylum seeking turned into irregular migration flows, and it was something that the community would not and did not tolerate. And since I moved to the UK 10 years ago, I see that absolutely playing out in mirror image here in Britain and across Western Europe. How much responsibility do we have to take for the application of asylum and the refugee system corrupting support for regular and legal migration?
This is actually very interesting because the 1951 Convention is predicated on a few key principles, but one of them stands out in this respect, which is responsibility sharing, right? The preamble says refugees are people that flee for things that are not their fault, and they go to another country where they're hosted by this other country, but this other country should not be the only one responsible to host them, because they should be an international responsibility. You know, that was an incredible intuition of the Refugee Convention, to say refugees are an international responsibility. And for a long time, how has that been translated? It has been translated into, fundamentally, sorry if I'm a bit blunt here, into poor countries taking the bulk of the refugees. Remember, refugees move essentially from one poor country to another poor country. Even now, even after Ukraine, where a lot of people went to Europe, more than 70% of the refugees are in the next country, which is usually low-income or middle-income countries. So those countries took the brunt of hosting, and the donor countries funded that hospitality. I'm simplifying a bit, but that was more or less the convention. It was imperfect because the cost of hosting cannot be measured in millions or billions. It's very, very complex. And it was when mobility increased 20, 25 years ago, and movements became more complex and bigger also, and people started moving in larger numbers to the rich countries. Australia was the first. And then, the US through the southern border and Europe, then that compromise, if you wish, started shaking. You mentioned the UK, like, and, you know, this is 40, 45,000 a year through the channels. Sometimes we have seen this in one day in a poor country. But, you know, you have countries saying, oh, my God, you know, we are now hosting refugees. We cannot give money anymore to other countries. Again, I'm simplifying. But this dynamic started happening. And especially that rhetoric of the populists that these people were coming to steal jobs and to bring insecurity and to destroy values, that caught on, became a political issue, allowed people to be elected in Australia too, and in Europe for sure. And that made any rational response to these different situations impossible. The rational response would have been, you know, for rich countries to say, let's look again at how we receive people. And there are ways to do it in the right manner, in the just manner, in an efficient manner, and not to push back and destroy the whole system just because we're now impacted.
If a national leader, for example, came to you and said, Filippo, we've just got too many undocumented immigrants, we've got too many Syrians or Lebanese or Sudanese who've arrived inside our country in the past few years, my voters are really worried about it. They think they're getting squeezed on jobs and on housing because of these refugees. How would you advise that national leader to, A, deal with the refugee flows or deal with the undocumented migrant flows, and also, I guess, reshape opinion at home?
I would say, first of all, recognize that this is a challenge. There are many practical things that can be done in terms of how people are treated when they arrive in these countries. It can become more efficient, more expeditious. And then the international community needs to set up a system to send back to the countries of origin those that are not recognized as refugees. This would immediately diminish the pressure. It is happening, but insufficiently. And then I would say rapid integration is the answer. Canada is a very good example in that respect, once again, because Canada, you know, from the day refugees arrive, declares them new Canadians and starts a very quick integration process. So there's a lot of things that can be done. A final point, how do you change the narrative? First of all, by having a different narrative. If you try to do that and at the same time you have people in your same government, as I've seen many times, saying, oh, but these people are a threat, these people are dangerous, then you have no chance to make this system work because public opinion will be against. You have to explain to public opinion why people come, like the Ukrainians in Europe, everybody understood, so we can explain this about others, and that will also create a better political environment for these difficult undertakings to be carried out.
I want to end a little where we began. You spoke of your frustration of not being able to resolve this conflict in Sudan, one that you think is kind of there for the taking and should be simpler than others say to resolve. When Donald Trump addressed the United Nations General Assembly last year, I was there, he brought the house down, and a lot of people, I think, secretly were nodding inside at a lot of his criticisms of the UN. Is there anything that you think he got right about the state of UN in trying to resolve or not some of these conflicts around the world? And what would you suggest to your former colleagues that they should do if they want to prevent a complete and total collapse of public support for the UN?
President Trump's rhetoric is a lot about a few things, a couple of things I would say regarding the UN. One is that the UN needs to refocus on peace and security. Fair enough, that's important. I think all of us in the UN would agree that peace and security is the raison d'etre of the United Nations. The problem is the United Nations can be involved and effective in establishing peace and security as long as its member states make it able to do that. you know, I'm worried when I see this new board of peace being almost presented as a competitor to the UN. I think that the UN has still legitimacy, but it needs to be given that space. And then the UN has, as a bureaucracy, has enormous capabilities and skills and experience to do that excruciating piecework that I was talking about. But it needs to be given that space. If that space is not given, and that's the responsibility, especially of the big powers, if we want to use old-fashioned words, to be given that space. The other thing that President Trump and many others, as a matter of fact, talk about is the effectiveness, efficiency. And there, I think, of course, the work that big bureaucracies do can always be improved. Bureaucracies, and I've battled with bureaucracy for 40 years, are difficult. And you have to constantly bring them back to the essentials, shed the extra weight. In the humanitarian area, you know, launched last year something called the RESET, also in response to American pressure. And I think that RESET is very good. It's already being applied to many complex emergencies. But remember, you know, there is a lot of frustration by some leaders that, oh, the UN, the humanitarian agencies are still there after 30 years. Well, you know, if you don't bring peace to Sudan now, we will be there after 30 years. And the bureaucracy will be more complex even to handle after 30 years. And by the way, we spoke about Sudan, but, you know, you can say the same about Myanmar. You can say the same about Congo. You can say the same about Afghanistan. There's such a long list of crises that are unresolved. And if you don't resolve them in the political sphere, the risk of dragging on and becoming a burden also for the international community is very high.
40 years dealing with crisis, how do you personally endure that? It must be tough sometimes.
I always say it is really the resilience of the people I have worked with. Refugees are really a concrete symbol, a concrete manifestation of that strength of spirit, of body, that has been such an example for me. I have always said, my God, if, you know, can I give up? Can I say impossible when these people don't give up and they never say it's impossible?
Filippo, thank you very much for all those thoughts and all your passion. I can see the UN is going to miss you playing that role in advocacy and going out and doing the work of humanitarianism. But good luck with your retirement.
And thank you for allowing me to play that role, although I'm out of the UN. Thank you.
So much to talk about there, Latika. I've got to say, he does have the experience and the gravitas to talk to these big questions, right? To hear him talk about Sudan with a sense of kind of shame at the international system's failing to manage to bring that to any kind of a resolution, the lack of energy when it comes to peace. And also what was, I think, a very pragmatic observation from him that there are other big conflicts around, right? You know, there's Gaza, Israel, there's Ukraine, and maybe we don't have the bandwidth to focus on too many things at the same time. But I think he very effectively made the case that we must bring Sudan back into the center of the frame.
Yeah, you know, I did think the one gap I detected was, I think people in the UN are not quite comfortable yet in really coming forward with what's gone wrong with the UN. And I think when they talk about reform, they blame the current architects and say, well, if we just had more people on the UNSC with a veto vote, that would represent the world a bit more. If we just did this around asylum and refugees, that would lead to more public acceptance. I'm not quite sure I hear yet a recognition from people inside that system that the system itself may be the problem.
Yeah, look, I think there was a nuance there from him, though. When you challenged him on that, he was able to admit that there are problems, that maybe the UN's focus is spread too broadly and it needs to return back to its core business. But I guess his argument too seemed to me to be that, look, it's an imperfect system, right? We fail time and time again, but there's a danger, there's a risk if we're thinking that there's any alternative, you know, that will necessarily be better, and let's not throw out the system we have in favour of a system that's not even built. I think that was what he was saying about the Board of Peace, right? We do have a structure for
exactly.
this. It's an unsatisfactory structure, but it works most of the time in a way that we want it to. Might be, I hope I'm not paraphrasing him unfairly there, but that seemed to be my...
No, I think it's a bit of a paraphrase of Winston Churchill. Democracy is the worst system until you look at all the others. The UN is terrible until you look at the Board of Peace. Maybe it's not so bad.
And just personally, I found it really interesting. You know, I often think to myself, you know, do more crises make us less likely to care? You know, do we run out of, it's called humanitarian fatigue, right?
What is your answer? I think yes is the answer to that, don't you?
But then you meet Filippo Grandi, right? This man has seen things go terribly wrong over and over and over again. And yet he is hopeful. He thinks the system can be applied in a way that is effective, and he takes his strength from the people he sees around him who are enduring and showing resilience in a way that he couldn't imagine. So I find that personally...
Yeah, for someone who could easily be jaded, he had a relentless optimism to him, didn't he?
Yeah, and which came from actually fully understanding those crises rather than reading about them and just, I suppose, taking a headline view of them.
Or letting the despair overwhelm you.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I found his vigour very, very infectious. And the thing that listeners aren't going to see was he spoke in a very Italian way, didn't he, Kylie? Hands
right.
were everywhere.
Lots
he was
of
very
hands.
Enthusiastic, very
lots,
expressive.
Lots of hands. Look, he was generous
he
with his
lived
time.
He up to his reputation.
Yeah,
he was exactly.
Great. I did, it was interesting to hear him reference the Board of Peace there. And we have had a few questions from listeners, actually, about that initiative, shall we call it that, by President Trump. Who's going to be on it? What exactly is it going to do? So Geraldine and Hamish are going to do their best to answer those questions for you in Monday's Your Call episode. But remember, you can send us your views and questions. We're always interested to know what you're thinking.
It's very easy, global.roaming@abc.net.au. And tomorrow, Geraldine and Hamish are back in the studio. They're talking, one of my favourite subjects, China. Who have they got on?
Well, it's Kaiser Guo. He's a Chinese-American podcaster who hosts a podcast called Sinica.
I listen to it every single episode.
Yeah, it's unmissable if you're interested in China. It's a kind of, how would you describe it? It's kind of a weekly deep dive, isn't it, into life, politics, culture in China.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. It's not just like, how is the security policy around China? It's what are people saying in China? How is this part of their culture affecting the policy around this? It's so interesting, so, so multifaceted.
And he is a former heavy rock guitarist, so he's got it all going on, Latika. And there's so much going on in China as well, so lots to talk about. Thanks for your company. We'll talk next week.
See you next week, Kylie.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.